everybody. Welcome to On the Bima, where we chat with Jewish theater makers from around the world about their art, Judaism, and vision for theater's future. I'm your host, Danielle Levski. This podcast is brought to you by the Alliance for Jewish Theater, a nonprofit organization made up of theater artists, theaters, and other people connected to theater to promote the creation, presentation, and preservation of both traditional and non-traditional theatrical endeavors by, for, and about the Jewish experience. Today, we're calling to the Bima founding artistic director of National Queer Theater, Adam Atzes Rubin, who is based in New York City. It is such an honor to have you as a guest in our show, Adam.
Thanks for having me, Danielle. I feel so powerful and fabulous up here on the Bima.
Ooh, good, good. We're going to get all juicy up there. We're going to ask some juicy questions.
I feel like I'm back in my bar mitzvah and I'm 13 and my voice is cracking.
Oh, no, don't know. No voice cracking on the podcast. It's okay. Well, before your voice starts cracking, let's talk about why we're here today. I just mentioned that you're the founding artistic director of National Queer Theater, which you started in 2018 with a mission to celebrate LGBTQ artists and provide a home for unheard voices. I'm curious what inspired you to start the organization. What did you see as the biggest need for this organization in the theater community?
Yeah, thanks so much for having me. So, when I was 16, I was growing up in California, and I was bullied a lot. And it was really less about sexuality and more about masculinity. And, you know, being harassed and abused, and with the backdrop being Prop 8 in California circa 2008, and these debates over gay marriage, and just hearing this really toxic rhetoric on the news, I felt so depressed and anxious and even suicidal for a period. And it wasn't until doing a production of the Laramie Project in my high school that I realized I was part of a larger community, part of a larger history, part of a larger culture that I knew nothing about, and that I wasn't the only gay kid in the world. And it was this real moment of revelation, and this light bulb went off. And I was like, wow, if theater can have such a profound impact on me, it can have an impact on other people. And especially thinking about queer youth, it just felt so powerful. And that's really the impetus that brought me all the way as an adult to starting National Queer Theater. And I think, you know, I had worked at the Queer Theater in San Francisco, New Conservatory Theater, which was just this wonderful artistic home for me as an actor, as a teacher, working in schools. And when I came to New York, realizing that there wasn't really a robust queer theater, I was like, there's so many queer people here. There's so many queer artists. There are queer plays happening on Broadway and off-Broadway. But in terms of a center for queer culture, where we could work with queer youth and have after-school programming, working with elders and people living with HIV and immigrants, like, it didn't feel like there was a holistic space outside of just a one-off play at a theater for us to gather. And with so many LGBTQ artists who, you know, are transplants to New York, who come to New York looking for a safe space, looking for a home, looking for community, looking for a place to create art, I just didn't see that. And I was like, well, if nobody else is going to do it, then I guess I have to. And inspired by the National Black Theater, I looked up, you know, is there a National Queer Theater that I can be an actor at or teacher? And nobody had taken the name. And I was like, okay, let me take this name, and went to GoDaddy.com and registered it for like $20. And yeah, that's how the theater was born while I was in grad school at NYU. And it's grown really quickly from there, because I think people are really looking for a safe space to create work and that sense of community.
Ah, that's wonderful. You touched on this a little bit in your answer, talking about wanting to see community and change created for youth, something that you wish you would have had when you were in high school, when you were a kid. And when we were preparing for this conversation, you mentioned that the Jewish notion of tikkun olam, meaning to repair the world, informs how your philosophy in theater. So could you share a little bit more about what that concept means to you, how it resonates with you? I know you started sharing that a little bit in your last answer, but let's really hone in on it.
Yeah. So when I was in high school, around the same time that I was doing this production of Laramie Project, I was part of this group called Jewish Youth for Community Action, called JICA, in the San Francisco Bay Area. And it was like this radical socialist activist Jewish youth group. Like, imagine, you know, training the future Bernie Sanders of the world. And we were going to protests around climate change. I mean, way back in 2008, 2009, we were talking about gender, we were talking about white privilege and institutional racism, and it was really ahead of its time. And at the same time, I was like building my identity as a young queer person and making friends with other closeted queer kids. And this group really instilled in me that what it means to be Jewish in America now is to be active in the community. It is to give back. It is to cultivate community for others. It is to be socially engaged. So I just grew up with that as part of the fabric of what it meant to be Jewish. My synagogue as a kid was called Kehila. It was a lot of older lesbian women with hairy armpits playing bongo drums. Like, it was a very hippie synagogue. And my rabbi had been arrested during the civil rights movement in the 60s and got very involved in Black Lives Matter. Like, it was a very radical space to grow up as a young Jewish person in Berkeley. So I've always carried those values with me. And I think now running Staging Pride, which is National Queer Theater's after school program for LGBT youth, you know, I really think of, I don't know if it was in the Talmud or it's like this Jewish saying of like, you save one life, you save the world. You kill one life, you kill the world. And studies show that when young people, and I'm thinking especially queer and trans young people, have one supportive adult in their life, it decreases rates of suicidality dramatically. So with this after school program, on the surface, we're putting on a show or doing drama games, and that's great and it's fun. But much deeper than that, I really consider it life-saving work because we're giving young people positive queer role models in the teachers who are part of the program. We're giving them community. We're giving them access to talk about their queerness, to talk about their transness, talk about gender, talk about race. And that might save a life down the road because it's giving them a safe space to be themselves. That's affirmative. And that can be really powerful for the mental health of young queer people. So the program is not explicitly Jewish at all, but I definitely bring my Jewish values as a, you know, 16-year-old radical young queer Jewish teenager attending my hippie synagogue and my socialist youth group. I bring that history with me to the work that I do now.
That's so wonderful. And that's such a great program that you're developing, Staging Pride. So from what we've learned about it, it's a free theater education program for queer youth. Is that right?
Yeah, absolutely. It's a after school free drama program. Young people come once or twice a week to the LGBT Center in the West Village in New York City. And they play theater games. They develop a new show and perform a new play. But more than that, yeah, they make friends with queer kids from other schools. And they get to talk about issues that they care about. And they get to see Broadway shows and have Broadway artists come in. We had Marsha from RuPaul's Drag Race come in last semester to do a Drag 101 workshop. And it was the same week that the drag ban in Tennessee was announced. And the young people had so much fun playing with drag, talking about gender identity. You know, for a lot of the trans youth, you know, thinking about drag as a way to practice performing as a gender different than the one they were assigned at birth, and, you know, practice putting on men's clothes or women's clothes, you know, whatever gendered clothing, and like performing in this role of like maybe in a way that they couldn't dress or act at school or at home, and really creating that safe space and feeling like, wow, like this queen from Drag Race is coming here to work with me. Like, that's so empowering for these young people. You know, pride is really the opposite of shame. And shame is what leads young queer people to these high rates of suicide.
Yeah.
So when we talk about pride, it's not just a parade. It's not just floats. It's not just that one day in June. It's that year-long permanent feeling of being secure and proud of our identities and having positive self-esteem. And that's what's going to, you know, nurture the future generation of leaders that we need in our community to advance our gay agenda.
Love it. Oh, that's so beautiful. And I completely agree with you, pride being the opposite of shame. I think a lot of the rhetoric that gets thrown out in conservative spaces is that why do queer people still need pride? Like, why is this parade? Like, we don't have a pride for whatever identity we belong to. You've never been shamed for your identity. You've never been told that you're wrong for being who you are based on where you've come from or what community you grew up in. So of course, like not just the 1 day celebration or the 1 month celebration, but the year long celebration of identity for queer people is so important.
Yeah. I mean, I tap into 12-year-old Adam and like he felt so lonely and isolated because we don't learn queer history at home. We don't learn about queer culture at home or in school. You know, growing up Jewish, I learned Jewish traditions, culture, history, going to, you know, weekend school, whatever, in the synagogue and, you know, from my family, from my parents, holidays. But I didn't get that for the queer side of myself.
Right.
I had to learn that on my own. I had to sneak into, you know, the gender section in Barnes and Nobles and find whatever books I could about gay people,
yeah.
you know, before Google, to just find any information I could about what it meant to be queer. So to have an after school program where we can explicitly talk about these things and where we can say this is a safe space to discuss these issues and discuss these feelings, it's incredibly empowering for the young people. And, you know, the rhetoric around like groomers is so tired, it's so old. You know, we're not convincing anyone to be anything they're not. These are young queer and trans people who just want a space where they can talk about these things openly and feel affirmed.
Right. Exactly. It's interesting too that you bring up that you had these spaces as a young Jewish person to go and learn about Jewish identity, culture, and history, because obviously Jews have faced our fair share of hostility, violence, hate, judgment, shame as well. But there has always been a really strong internal community history presence that allows you to shield yourself from those hateful voices and allows you to feel secure in your identity as a Jewish person. Whereas as queer people, we don't have that. Well, now we're starting to have that thanks to people like you, organizations like yours. But in the past, there was no spaces like this for young people to feel who they were holistically and fully and feel proud of that. I think that's really wonderful.
Yeah. And I think there's also, you know, a need to talk about more the intersectionality between being queer and being Jewish, you know,
mm-hmm.
talk about the Holocaust, which we talk a lot about in the Jewish community, but to talk about what was the impact on LGBT people in the Holocaust, to talk about the queer people, Jewish or not Jewish, who were sent to the concentration camps, who were persecuted. What is the impact of that? What is the legacy of that?
Mm-hmm.
To talk about the pinkwashing that the Israeli government does to say, oh, Israel is the, you know, only accepting place for gay people in the Middle East, and therefore that makes other countries backwards or barbaric and manipulating people through that washing rhetoric. And, you know, whether you agree with that or not,
yeah.
whatever your politics are, you know, I think we just need to have more of these conversations as LGBT Jews and our allies. What is at this intersection? What is the experience of being a queer Jew?
Mm-hmm. Definitely. I'm curious to where you find that intersection now and the work you're doing with National Queer Theater and the work you've seen in the United States or across the world between queer and Jewish stories, where that's coming together.
Yeah, I think it's, you know, I think being a Jewish person in America is really complicated. I find that in a city like New York, where there's a lot of Jewish people, you know, being Jewish is not highly persecuted, at least not for someone who looks like me, maybe for the Hasidic community. But, you know, I really find it's more that I have white privilege than I have Jewish persecution.
Mm-hmm.
There are absolutely hate crimes against Jewish people, especially in the Hasidic community. And I feel defensive of that. But I feel like more so I have to acknowledge my privilege as a white person, even as a white Jew.
Mm-hmm.
And at the same time, looking across the country, you know, looking at Charlottesville, Jews will not replace us. Like, we still have to stay vigilant. And I think there's a lot of solidarity we can have between Jewish people and queer people
mm-hmm.
as groups that understand what it means to be oppressed. And I think I draw on my family's heritage as Jews, as, you know, Jews who left Russia, Ukraine, during the pogroms, coming to America. With National Queer Theater, I helped start the Criminal Queerness Festival, which you participated in, which showcases international LGBTQ artists who might be facing persecution or censorship in their home countries because of their gender and sexuality. And I work a lot with asylum seekers. I work a lot with refugees.
Mm-hmm.
And I really think a lot about my ancestors who came here on a boat through Ellis Island, fleeing persecution, having to start over in America as refugees, and tying that to, you know, a lot of the queer refugees I work with and thinking about what we owe our queer community around the world as Americans.
Yeah, wonderfully said. I want to dig in a little bit more into your mention of the Criminal Queerness Festival, which was a wonder to participate in this year. So this past June, for our audience, the 5th annual Criminal Queerness Festival took place at the Lincoln Center with National Queer Theater, and it specifically focused on LGBTQ artists from Ukraine and Eastern Europe. I was lucky enough to be selected for this process, and I was there alongside two other wonderful playwrights who also put up their work. It was an amazing experience. We also got to meet some of the prior playwrights and prior performers and artists that were involved in previous years' Criminal Queerness Festivals, and it was just such a beautiful community to be a part of and such a powerful moment to showcase three very different works, all focused on Eastern European queer identity. So I'm curious, Adam, how did you go about curating and developing this type of festival? And what was the collaboration process like at the beginning, the very first festival versus this past one in June?
Yeah, great question. You know, I think with all of the programs I run, it's all about creating community. So it's about involving a lot of artists in the process. So with the Criminal Queerness Festival, in terms of the curation process, you know, I always try to prioritize the people who are most impacted by the work. So queer immigrants, refugees, asylum seekers in the curation process. And this year, one of NQT's volunteers, an actor named Sasha Karpivkin, who was an actor in the festival, who's from Ukraine, came to me when the war was starting and was like, I think we need to focus on Ukraine with this festival and bring in Ukrainian artists and really shine a light on the LGBTQ community in Ukraine. So Sasha was really a thought partner along with some other artists like Dmitry Barkomi, who's worked a lot in Poland, Begzi Inal, who's an important artist in our community, who's originally from Turkey, really scouting and seeing what kind of works are out there, who are artists we know, how do we find Ukrainian artists to connect with and artists from Eastern Europe, and just started reading plays and really having conversations around like, what are the stories we want to tell right now? What's going to uplift this community the most through this platform at Lincoln Center, which is a tremendous honor and privilege to perform there and a real spotlight. How it's changed since the first year, we just have a wider network, you know, more playwrights, artists have gone through the festival now, and they are always keeping an eye on new artists to bring into the fold. You know, we have this rich network of alumni now who are all over the world, who have input on the festival and the artists we work with, and, you know, over the years have just gained experience in what it means to produce international work, what it means to bring artists to New York to create work, how to create the best experience for artists, how to talk about the work in a way that's not saying that America is better than anywhere else, or to not come from a totally Eurocentric perspective, to not come from any kind of tokenizing perspective when working with especially artists from the global South, and to really care for the artist's full humanity, knowing that for some of the artists we work with in this festival, they can't be out in their countries for their own safety. Some artists need to leave their country for their safety. Some artists need to be anonymous. And really just thinking through safety, security, and how we can create the most empowering experience for all the artists who come through this festival.
That's really wonderful. Thank goodness. And it's really great to see the festival grown so much in just 5 years. That's incredible. Also through a pandemic, which is another question I wanted to ask about, slightly related to the pandemic. What are some of the biggest challenges you faced as an organization uplifting queer and trans stories, and how have you navigated those obstacles?
I think in terms of specifically uplifting queer and trans stories, you know, we're just like a sponge for whatever's happening around the country. So what we've seen over the past 5 years is more extreme anti-trans rhetoric from the far right. We've seen laws being passed to criminalize trans youth and their parents, to ban drag shows and penalize drag artists, which is closely tied to the anti-trans rhetoric, because I don't think a lot of people on the far right really understand the difference between trans people and drag queens, unfortunately. And so with that backlash, an even greater need to uplift trans artists and trans stories and really focus our efforts on that. There was a weird thing that happened in 2020 where the greater focus on racial justice in the country, I think, also had a trickle-down effect to other marginalized communities. And we found that other institutions, funders, theaters suddenly gave us support as a minority-led theater in a way that we didn't see in 2018, 2019, which we're happy to take advantage of. So, you know, I don't know if Lincoln Center would have invited us to perform there before George Floyd, before Black Lives Matter and the pandemic, but something about that reckoning around diversity has been beneficial to an organization like ours that is focused on social justice, that is focused on equity and diversity, and helped us get our work further.
That's wonderful. But yeah, you're right. Unclear if the major institutions would have supported marginalized communities like they have since 2020. But yeah, it has been wonderful seeing National Queer Theater and other organizations get so much more support and press and funding since that time, even if it might be a little performative.
Hey, we'll take it.
Yeah. So on the more positive note on the types of accolades and opportunities you've gotten for National Queer Theater in the past few years, I wanted to also hear about what excites you most about the current landscape of LGBTQ theater and performance. And what more would you like to see?
I'm thrilled with the current landscape. You know, when The Boys in the Band came out in the late 60s, even before Stonewall, none of those actors were out of the closet. They couldn't be out of the closet. Most of them ended up dying of AIDS in the 80s. You know, the queer theaters that did pop up in the 80s that started kind of this movement of like queer specific nonprofit theaters, none of them could put gay or queer in their name because people were worried about getting mail that had the word gay on it. So the fact that National Queer Theater even can exist is like a miracle. It's amazing that we can even have a theater called National Queer Theater. And still sometimes when I go to the bank or have to do some business things and they are like, well, oh, what's your organization called? I'm like, National Queer Theater. Like, I think they're going to have some homophobic reaction. But the fact that we can exist without getting a ton of hate mail is a positive step. What I want to see more of is, I think, a deeper investment from non-queer theaters in holistically supporting the queer community, especially when they produce LGBTQ work. So it's great to have shows like The Inheritance or Slave Play on Broadway, The Prom, all these queer-themed shows, but I'm like, how can we go deeper? You know, can you contribute to the work we're doing at National Queer Theater? Can you do workshops with these Broadway actors for queer youth? How can we invest deeper in the whole community, not just within the four walls of the theater and selling tickets to queer people? I think I also want to find a national platform for these queer theaters around the country, not just National Queer Theater, but, you know, like Outfront Theater in Atlanta or Aboutface Theater in Chicago, or even some smaller queer theaters in the Midwest and the South. You know, they're really struggling. They're on the front lines. You know, when I talk to them about what they need, they're talking about security guards because the Proud Boys are coming to their shows and protesting.
Yeah.
The reality of doing queer theater in different parts of the country is very, very different than what it's like to do it in Brooklyn. So I really want to uplift these institutions and these artists around the country who are doing really important work and really fighting back against the kind of censorship we're seeing from Ron DeSantis in Florida or from, you know, what's happening in Tennessee or Texas. And I just want to celebrate queer artists. I mean, there's so many fabulous artists who are doing incredible work, from the writers to the actors, stage managers, designers. There's so much talent out there, and I just want to grow so we have the capacity to do more shows and pay people more money and do more programs like Staging Pride, like Criminal Queerness Festival, and just provide more opportunities for queer artists to show how brilliant and fabulous they are.
On the note of brilliant and fabulous, you also have another program that's really wonderful that's coming up on the horizon, Write It Out, which is a playwriting program for people living with HIV and AIDS. It was originally created by Danja R. Love. I'd love if you could share a little bit more about what's in store for Write It Out in 2023 and how this program connects to NQT's mission and the communities you were just mentioning and everything you aim to serve.
Absolutely. So a little backstory. In 2019, National Queer Theater got a grant to support community outreach for Donye Love's performance of One and Two off Broadway with the new group. And with these funds, we were able to give away free tickets to people living with HIV to come see this show and organize talkbacks, have a table outside of the theater with different HIV services, both prevention and treatment. And after the production, Donye came to me and said, hey, I would really love to start a class for people living with HIV, a playwriting class. Mm-hmm. And Donye is an amazing teacher. And I was like, oh, of course, we'd love to help. So it's really Donye's program, and National Queer Theater is a support, is a partner, is a producer of Donye's Write It Out program. It's a free playwriting program for people living with HIV that takes place every fall. And the participants write 10-minute plays. It could be about HIV, it could be about anything else that they want to write about. And we hire professional actors and directors to perform their 10-minute plays on World AIDS Day. And in 2021, we started the Write It Out Prize for a professional playwright living with HIV and awarded that to Dominic Cologne with support from Billy Porter and GLAAD. It's a $5,000 prize for a professional playwright living with HIV, because there's plenty of plays about AIDS, like Anxious in America, Rent, Normal Heart, that we've talked about, but very few of them are written by people living with HIV. So Write It Out really expands, again, going back to the canon of queer theater. Mm-hmm. In 2023, we're keeping the program virtual, the writing class, because we love that people in Texas and Alaska and Montana are able to access this program and be a part of it. But we're going to do the final reading in person, and we have even funds to help fly people out for the final reading if they're outside of the tri-state area. And we're going to do this at the LGBT Center where ACT UP started on December 2nd in honor of World AIDS Day.
Wow.
And we're going to have this beautiful celebration of people living with HIV, of artists living with HIV and their stories, and continue growing this beautiful program.
That's so wonderful. And I think that ties perfectly into Tikkun Olam. How better to repair the world than to offer so many wonderful queer theater artists the ability to have their voice and their work read and created with National Queer Theater in this way.
Yeah, our goal is to not create art for art's sake, but art for the sake of queer liberation. So whenever I'm thinking about a new program or a new partnership, it's always like, how can this advance the cause of queer liberation? It's not about getting a great review in the New York Times. It's about supporting the movement. And I hope that as National Queer Theater grows, we're come to be seen as the theater arm of the queer liberation movement, and that activists and artists really have a space to organize, to express themselves, and to support one another. And programs like Write It Out, like Criminal Queerness Festival, like Staging Pride, are really in service of that mission.
Wonderful. My goodness. Thank you so much for joining us today, Adam.
Thank you, Danielle. It's great to be here.
And thank you, listeners, for tuning in to On the Bima. A special thanks to Danny Debner, our technical producer, Ilya Levinson and Alex Kaufman, the composers of our theme music, and the entire Alliance for Jewish Theater community. This podcast was brought to you by the Alliance for Jewish Theater. If you like what you've heard today, support this podcast and all of our initiatives towards connecting Jewish theater makers by making a tax-deductible donation to Alliance for Jewish Theater at alljewishtheater.org or joining as a member. Make sure to give us a review on iTunes and learn more about us at alljewishtheater.org. I'm your host, Danielle Levski, and I'll chat with you next time. L'chaim.